I just wanted to say that the inspiration for bringing Alberto here was because there's nothing more fermenting in my brain, I suppose, than the concept of the library and the imagination. Thinking about a library is one thing, but inventing it is another. And that's what we do as artists. We are artists inventing the library. We invent it in more ways than one. We invent it because we have studios full of books, and in the juxtaposition of those books, we are inventing a new library. But we are also adding books to the library. And in the invention of the library, we also are inventing readers. And as artists, this is more or less our job, is to invent readers. In fact, some of us are doing such a crazy job of it that the readers are becoming confused. And I think that might be the intention of some of us, is to make readers somewhat confused so that they have to begin to look closely at what we do in order to find out if there's missing something. And then they discover all kinds of wonderful imaginary things and real things that you have brought to work. Alberto Mangrell invents both libraries and readers. He's a man who lives in a library that he is in process of inventing, and he is not only creating people to read because he is writing books about the history of reading and library, and his imaginary journeys in his books, like The Library at Night, you know, brings all of this together. I just thought it would be a fitting way for us to end our day here, is to hear Alberto Mangrell. Thank you.
See people who are interested in reading, interested in books, interested in libraries, and who also create the books. It is absolutely splendid. Now, Ken said that I disturbed his work process by bringing up comments on Diderot. Well, he has done the same with me, because in the division that he quoted from Diderot, the division of society amongst those who work with their hands and those who pretend to sit and think, I'm facing an audience of people who work with their hands, and I'm on the other side, alas. I'm going to be speaking about the Universal Dream Library. In an introduction to an anthology of dreams compiled in 1976, Jorge Luis Borges, whom Inés has used as her source, quoting Addison, wrote that the human soul, when it dreams, becomes at the same time the stage, the actors, and the public. And he could have added, and the dreamer himself, the author of the story he is seeing. A literal reading of this metaphor, Borges continues to say, might lead to the dangerously compelling thesis that dreams are the oldest and most complex of the literary genres. Now, if that is so, the genre must be divided, as genres are, into dreams invented in sleep and those invented in our waking hours. Our daydreams, however, never attain the perfection of those dreamt at night. At night, the stories we tell ourselves satisfy every one of the strict rules imposed by the genre itself, rules that are, in spite of the efforts of shamans and psychoanalysts, largely incomprehensible to us during the day. The dreams constructed when we are awake lack the fundamental knowledge of the genre's mechanics. We can imitate a night dream, but never attain its perfection. One day in 1842, the 38-year-old Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote in his notebook, "To write a dream which shall resemble the real course of a dream with all its inconsistency, its eccentricities and aimlessness, with nevertheless a leading idea running through the whole, up to this old age of the world, no such thing has ever been written." Indeed. From the first dream of Gilgamesh 4,000 years ago up to this day, Hawthorne's observation proves to be right. Something in the retelling of a dream, however haunting and however true, lacks the peculiar verisimilitude of dreams, their unique vocabulary and texture, their singular identity. It is possible that Hawthorne, himself the writer of remarkable dreams, literary dreams that is, was pointing at something more than the ineffability of dreams, something to do with the nature of language and storytelling. As we learn to our cost, language always approximates, never seizes completely whatever it is that you want to tell. Naming a thing or a condition, describing a place or an event, a writer uses language to build a verbal image out of a few chosen bits and pieces of a reality perceived or imagined to be perceived, all the while knowing that she herself is incapable of encompassing the whole in all its fleeting dimensions. And yet, in order to engage the reader in a mutual contract of faith, the writer must pretend that the reality portrayed in words has factual precision and coherence. So ingrained is this procedure that a writer often attempts to disguise this supposed precision with rhetorical tricks. For instance, by not revealing everything, by saying, "En un lugar de la Mancha de cuyo nombre no quiero acordarme," or by pretending not to reveal everything, "Call me Ishmael." But the case of dreams prove that such devices are ineffectual. Real dreams don't assume the all-knowing confidence of waking life. Dreams don't imply, as waking life does, a provable, tangible state of being that would only require infinite time and flawless senses for us to perceive it entirely. Dreams humbly admit their imperfect condition, their kaleidoscopic, changing, fleeting nature. Hawthorne says he discerns in dreams, quote, "a leading idea running through the whole," unquote, like a narrative backbone. But in this, he may be merely hopeful. Too often, dreams appear in seemingly disconnected fragments, like scattered pages from a book, which is the image Dante uses for his last great vision. We can, psychoanalysis teaches us, learn to read a narrative in this randomness, but then we can read narrative in anything, even in the meaningless universe. After all, our species is best defined as reading animals. But if we admit that in waking life, which we do quite successfully put into stories, also has an incoherence of its own, that the threads that we follow in life as they interweave with countless other threads form a web whose pattern we can barely discern, much less conceive or understand, that the telling of dreams can be seen as simply another form of storytelling. Neither more nor less accurate than a realistic novel, and another happy pretense of describing and explaining what lies beyond explanation and description. Astrophysics uses mathematical formulae to discover the laws that rule the universe, common laws for all things, big and small, while simultaneously admitting that the models of the universe produced by this formula lie outside our capabilities of representation. Stephen Hawking, for example, has admitted that the theories he has developed to explain certain cosmic mysteries assume a cosmic model that he himself cannot visualize. If that is the case, if manageable mathematical formulae serve to unscramble what cannot be concretely imagined, then why not allow our capabilities of representation, in words at least, to build models of the world that will stand for our experience of the world, while admitting that the world itself refuses to be pictured or named. And I think that this is what many of you do when you create artist works. Alice, whose experience of dreams is one of the deepest and most convincing of all literature, is quite ready to admit that words cannot be used to name the endless plurality of the world. When Humpty Dumpty tells her that he uses the word glory to mean there's a nice knockdown argument for you, because Humpty Dumpty says to Alice, well, there's glory for you. And she says, I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean by glory. And he says, well, by glory, I mean a nice knockdown argument. And Alice objects that glory does not mean a nice knockdown argument. And Humpty Dumpty retorts, when I use a word, he says in a scornful tone, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. Alice, who is always rational in this crazy world, says, well, the question is whether you can make words mean so many different things. The question is, Humpty Dumpty answers, which is to be the master? That is all. Well, no doubt the writer's task is to embrace Humpty Dumpty's faith in the powers of language and to be the master, while at the same time convincing Alice that he submits to the rules of a shared understanding, rules over which the words themselves hold dominion. Of course, both Humpty Dumpty and Alice, both writer and reader, know more or less consciously that all this is a pretense to which we must resign ourselves if literature is to exist at all. Borges himself keenly analyzes paradox in a short text he called Dream Tigers. After telling us that his favorite animal is the tiger since his childhood, when he would go to the zoo and admire the beast in its cage, he finds that sometimes when he is asleep, he becomes conscious that he is dreaming. And at that point, he says, I am dreaming, I am the master of my dreams, and so I can dream whatever I want, so why not dream a tiger? And Borges says, ah, the feebleness of the craft. The tiger appears, but with impurities of form, too big or too small, or, he says in a wonderful Argentinian Spanish phrase, o tirando a perro a pájaro, which means, or tending towards a bird or a dog. This is what always happens when we try to create something in the imagination. The form is perfect. And when we try to make it concrete, it does not approximate that perfection. It will do in the best of cases, but it's not that thing. The writer who knows he is dreaming becomes something like the editor of his own text, unable to stop himself from messing things up. Consciousness doesn't allow us to enjoy the show we have mounted unawares. In the same way that we cannot faithfully construct a dream while asleep, awake we are unable to put into words the complexity of the dream world. To avoid or bypass the incompetence, a literary dream, the story of a dream, must be organized differently, made to assume other objectives, appear less keen in reproducing a real dream than in fitting something called a dream into the logic and tone of the narrative. Perhaps the only success to which the writer can aspire in dream telling is to make the reader believe that the characters themselves believe the dream to be a dream. It doesn't matter if we as readers, to use three biblical examples, know that the dreams that Joseph tells his brothers are prophetic, or that the dreams that Nebuchadnezzar tells Daniel are allegorical, or that Joseph's dream about Mary's pregnancy is explanatory. Each of these dreams works within the narrative that contains it and is justified by it and illuminates it. Sometimes the story only pretends to be a dream. We accept, but I'm not really convinced, that Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress is a story of a dream, or that Dorothy's adventures in Oz are a dream. The method of framing the narrative in a dream is a sort of excuse for the writer, who can argue that, since this is a dream, everything that takes place in it is possible. However, rather than add verisimilitude to a story, such devices make the reader conscious of how even the attempt at the incoherence of a dream must answer the strict laws of fictional logic. Things may happen that in a realistic story would perhaps be impossible, but even the impossible things must follow rules of cause and consequence. After running away from home, Pilgrim can arrive in any country, and after being whisked away by the tornado, Dorothy can land anywhere in the world, but in both cases, it must be somewhere, and that somewhere must be mapped for the reader's guidance. The surrealists, as we know, attempted a few deliberately incoherent dream narratives, but we read them less as examples of real dreams, as displays of verbal virtuosity. Sometimes the story tells a dream only better to question the nature of what we call reality, as in the famous story of Huang Su and the butterfly. You all know it. Huang Su dreamed that he was a butterfly, and when he woke, he didn't know if he was a man who dreamt he was a butterfly, or was a butterfly now dreaming it was a man. Earlier, Socrates had asked the same question to one of his bewildered disciples. I've started one of my seminars on Borges, asking my students the same question. How can you know whether this moment you are sleeping and all your thoughts are a dream, or whether you are awake and talking to one another? And I wait till they try to prove it. Alice faces an even more terrifying conundrum in when Tweedledee and Tweedledum meet her in the wood, where the Red King is lying asleep at the foot of a tree, and according to Tweedledee, dreaming of her. Now, if that king, says Tweedledum, were to wake, you'd go out, bang, like a candle. And then Alice starts to cry, and she says, well, my tears prove that I'm real. And Tweedledum says with scorn, you don't suppose that those are real tears? Segismundo, in Calderón's Life is a Dream, does not know how to distinguish between waking life and dream life, though his audience does. And Segismundo must wait for hard reality to teach him the difference. Hamlet's doubts are the same as Sigismundo's, but expressed in reverse. It is bad dreams that let Hamlet know that he's not bounded in a nutshell, counting himself king of infinite space. Now, the apparent confusion between the reality of dreams and the reality of waking life, like the confusion between madness and dreams, which Socrates notes in the same dialogue, just to make it more confusing, allows writers to use dreams to question reality without having to attempt an impossible imitation of a dreamlike state. In one of his unpublished notebooks, Coleridge famously wrote, "If a man could pass through paradise in a dream and have a flower presented to him as pledge that his soul had really been there, and if he found that flower in his hand when he awoke, eh, and what then?" So unanswerable is that question, so neatly does it blend the reality of dreams and reality, that H.G. Wells, in order to lend verisimilitude to the nightmarish story, The Time Machine, borrowed Coleridge's unsettling supposition and concluded his story with just such a flower, which the time traveler finds wilted in his hand. In a literature, dreams often serve to bring the impossible into the fabric of everyday life, like mist through a crack in the wall. Unfortunately, it often happens that dreams are brought in as an alibi for an unbelievable plot, and the device fails through the writer's ineptitude. It's all a dream, and this, in a number of supernatural stories, can only be called a cop-out. In the best of cases, the reader is simply not convinced. In the worst, the conclusion dilutes whatever power the story might have held in its own right. Robert Louis Stevenson, whose Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde began in a real nightmare, he confessed, this is interesting for artists, he confessed to having dreamt of a terrifying shade of brown. But fortunately, he did not end his story by having the tortured hero wake up and deny that anything atrocious had really happened. Kafka, of course, reversed the procedure to great effect. It's not the dream, but real life, that proves to be Gregor's nightmare when he wakes up from disturbing dreams to find himself transformed into a monstrous insect. Nabokov, commenting on the story, said to his class that Gregor doesn't realize that he is a winged beetle and that under the shell he has wings. And he says to his class, "Many a John, many a Jane go through life without realizing that they have wings under the shell." Dostoevsky used a different method. To lend his story a feeling of anguish and unease, he had one of the characters in The Possessed tell his beloved of a dream. "Last night, I dreamt that you led me into a place inhabited by a spider the size of a man, and that we spent the rest of our lives watching it in terror." Accepting the limitations of a conscious dreamer, Borges, throughout his life, but especially after he became blind in the mid-50s, constructed a dream library for himself in which books that had not been written and books that had been transformed shared the evanescent shells. An omnivorous, eclectic, whimsical, and wise reader, Borges took from the books he read pages or paragraphs, or sometimes just a sentence that he collected with others in his mind as a sort of patchwork of his own design. I will tell you here an anecdote from Chateaubriand. He's talking about the French moralist Joseph Joubert. And Chateaubriand says that in his library, which was extensive, Flaubert had only, exclusively, works that he liked. And in order to have only works that he liked, in every book he would tear out the pages he didn't like. The library of Flaubert was a tattered and without some covers, and Chateaubriand was very impressed. But Borges assembled from the pages that he liked books that he then recreated as mental anthologies. And in those dream volumes, Nicholas and William Blake rubbed shoulders. Plato echoed a certain idea in William James. St. John of the Cross and James Joyce conversed in amicable silence. Borges said that we never remember a novel in its entirety, only certain scenes and certain fragments that we abridge or expand according to our pleasure or distaste. So he reworked the library in his memory, sometimes misquoting with utter confidence for the sake of exploring an idea. After all, if, as Shelley and Valerie suggested, all of literature is the work of a single inspired author, Borges allowed himself the right of one of his trusted scribes to amend a page of the colossal work in progress. In a famous essay, Kafka's Precursors, that touches on the idea Ken mentioned of taking Diderot as a beginning, he suggests that every writer creates his own precursors, and that after reading The Castle, a reader notices the affinities of Kafka with Zeno, with an apologist of the Chinese sage Han Yu, with Kierkegaard, with Robert Browning, with Léon Blois, with Lord Dunsany. If I'm not mistaken, Borges says, the text of these authors resemble that of Kafka. If I'm not mistaken, they don't resemble one another. Kafka, according to Borges, is the link in this dream library. We could say that the link is Borges, or rather, Borges's dream books. As Borges makes clear, we, the readers, all furnish our mental libraries with constantly changing anthologies that bind and separate, intersperse, and tear apart the pages of our reading. Karel Čapek, in his wonderful book on gardens, says that the art of gardening can be reduced to one root: you put into it more than you take out. The same can be said of the art of libraries. But the libraries of our material world, however great their hunger, can only hoard existing volumes. We know that every book holds within it all possible readings, past, present, future, but its reincarnations, those wonderful forms which depend on readers to come, will not be found on our shelves. Colette tells an anecdote about her friend Paul Masson, who worked at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. And he was visiting her, and she noticed that he was writing catalog cards of books in Latin of a certain period. And so she said to him, "You have a wonderful memory. You're here, the library is in Paris, and you're writing these catalog cards." And he says, "Well, I noticed that there were certain deficiencies in the library, and I am filling them by inventing the titles that should be in the library." And so Colette was astounded, and she said, "Well, but are you going to write the books afterwards?" And Paul Masson became indignant, and he said, "Well, I can't do everything." But Borges agreed Once in the early years of his friendship with Adolfo Bioy Casares, he suggested to the younger writer that they compose together a history of the literature of an imaginary country that would include the books of which they had dreamt but never written. Borges felt that to dream up plots was a profound intellectual pleasure, but to write a novel, he said repeatedly, was an exaggeration. He preferred to review and compose introductions for non-existent books. His Pierre Benin, author of Don Quixote, is conceived as part of a festschrift for this apocryphal but necessary genius who decides in the 20th century to write Don Quixote once more, and in doing so renews our reading of Don Quixote. You remember the classic story where Borges compares a paragraph of the Quixote of Cervantes to the identical words in a paragraph written by Pierre Menard. And he says, well, in Cervantes, the fact that the truth, whose mother is history, etc., is simply a rhetorical enumeration that belongs to Cervantes' time. But said by Pierre Menard in the 20th century, after Bertrand Russell, to conceive truth as the issue of history, to say that what we tell about history is the truth, is radical and revolutionary. They are the same word.
It's identical.
One mysterious copy of the encyclopedia that Inés has mentioned includes an entry to Tlön Ugbar, the imaginary land of an imaginary universe that doesn't remain imaginary, it begins to materialize in our world. There was a wonderful exhibition on Borges in Barcelona, Cosmopolis, where among the manuscripts and the books of his library, they had the imaginary objects. They had the volume of the encyclopedia with a printed page about Clern and so on. The Book of Sand, in the story of the same title, is a volume of almost infinite pages, so that when you open it, you will look upon a page that you will never see again. Borges' story, Approach to Almutasi, purports to be the review of a detective story written by a certain Indian lawyer. The illustrated original, we are told, was published in Bombay in 1932 and reprinted by the well-known detective story publisher Victor Bollaerts in London 2 years later, with an introduction by Dorothy L. Sayers. Both very real. Now, the Approach to Almutasim appeared for the first time not in a periodical, as did Borges's, most of Borges's pieces, but in a collection of essays called History of Eternity. And the fact that it was published in a volume of nonfiction in an appendix that carried the sober title of two notes, one of which was this review and the other was a lovely text on the art of insulting, suggested to its first readers that the author, Mir Bahadur Ali, was a real person and that his book, under the respectable imprint of Gollancz, was available for purchase. So, intrigued by Borges's enthusiastic review, his friend Adolfo Bioy Casares ordered a copy from London, unsuccessfully. We should remember that fiction often imposes itself on reality. Conan Doyle's creation was so real to many of its readers that the London Postal Service had to set aside a special official to deal with the correspondence addressed to Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Esquire. A few days, I'm finishing with this last paragraph. A few days after having written in his notebook about the impossibility of narrating dreams, Hawthorne made another entry. A dream the other night that the world has become dissatisfied with the inaccurate manner in which facts are reported, and had employed me with a salary of $1,000 to to relate things of public importance exactly as they happen. Surely, Hawthorne was aware of the wonderful paradox of having a dream, a state which he earlier described as impossible to relate precisely, engaging him to report events exactly as they happen, at a salary of $1,000 too, no doubt a vast sum in the mid-19th century. Perhaps this was Hawthorne's way, or the way of Hawthorne's dreams, of admitting the truth about the writer's so-called craft, that it consists of a morbid compulsion to make up stories in order to acknowledge our human condition, in spite of knowing that his instrument is unreliable, his perception of things blurred, his understanding of the world muddled, his reliance on the reader's goodwill often unjustified. In the 19th book of the Odyssey, which Virgil, of course, knew well, Penelope speaks of dreams and says that they come forth through two gates, one made of burnished ivory, for the dreams that deceive us, and one of glistening horn, for the dreams that tell us the truth. Perhaps writers must content themselves with using only the ivory gate for their dreams, knowing that their craft consists in telling lies. Except that the lies told by writers are not untruth, they are merely not real. Errori non falsi, Dante, who knew what he was doing, called them lies that are not false. The distinction is important. Thank you.
Yes.
What is your perception of the book arts in terms of the application of trying to describe or present dreams? Have you looked at artist books enough to get the same thing?
It's an attempt. What is the role of the art book or the artist book in representing this ineffable reality? Sometimes it approaches success, but no human craft is perfect. We have invented the device of metaphors because we know that language cannot name what we want to name. Chesterton says that in spite of knowing the feebleness of language, we believe that from the innards of an ordinary stockbroker issue grunts and squeals that denote all the hues of memory and all the fires of desire. We believe, we want to believe that it's possible. But I think that the question implies the idea that we can be successful. And I think that perhaps this idea comes from a mercantile society that believes in profit, in material profit. But I think that perhaps the essential element of any creative act is failure. That a work of art that we consider successful is dead. that it has no place to evolve in the imagination of those who read it or see it. Robert Louis Stevenson, in a wonderful sermon, he says, our function is in life is not to succeed, but to continue to fail in the best of spirits. Yes.
If all translations are new creations, can you talk about how that fluidity, can you talk about translation a little bit and how you feel that fits into what you're saying about the inevitability of the language?
In the strictest term, translation of one text in a certain language to that same text in another language is, I think, the most profound act of reading, that the translator is the keenest reader, the most intelligent reader. Now, at the same time, we are reluctant to acknowledge up to what point the work of a translator is a work of art. I believe that every translation should be signed by the translator and the name of the original writer put in small print. Well, because we say, well, I say, I don't speak a word of Russian, I don't speak a word of Japanese, I don't speak a word of Arabic, but I can say that I've read Dostoevsky, or that I've read Seishon Agon, or that I've read Naguib Mahfouz. But I it's not true. I've read translations of those works. And what does a translator do? He performs this miracle. There was a conundrum in the Middle Ages, very popular, that said, if you take a person and you replace the person's legs, and you replace a person's arms, and you replace a person's heart, and which surgery can now do, is that person still the same person? Well, what is a poem? A poem is a bunch of words chosen for whatever reasons, set in a certain sequence, that have in the reading a certain tone, a certain music, a certain rhythm, and that are ruled by a certain grammar. Well, take away the words, take away the sequence, take away the music, take away the tone, take away the grammar, and replace all those by others from another language. Can you still say that you're reading The Possessed or Don Quixote? Can you say that you're reading the book? Well, somehow, and I don't know how, you can. But you have to admit what I believe is an essential principle of language. We believe in language as a tool. And I would extend that to the language of color, the language of form, the language of sound. We believe in language as a tool. But we are not entirely in control of the tool. It is that tool that dictates to us what you can do. When Ken was doing his presentation, he talked about the compass and he talked about the hammer, and but you cannot use these tools for anything. You cannot write with a hammer, you cannot hammer with a compass. And not just because you don't want to, because the instrument dictates what you can do. And in the same sense, language tells us what ideas we can have and what literary forms we can construct. And we cannot, because unless we distort language, we cannot have those same ideas. I'll give you a very basic example and I'll stop. What is the best known quotation in English literature? To be or not to be? Well, Shakespeare writes this beautifully concise, metaphysical, essential question, because he's writing in English. If he were writing in Spanish or Italian, the idea would have never occurred to him, because to be in English is to exist existentially and to be physically in a place. Well, in Spanish you have ser o estar, you have to choose. So usually a translator who translates to be or not to be chooses the existential side and says ser o no ser. But if he loses, or she loses, estar o no estar. So I don't know what Shakespeare would have done if he were writing in Spanish. He would probably have written something like Borges writes in a sonnet about the same idea. Entra la luz y haciendo torpemente de los sueños al sueño compartido, y cada cosa recobra su debido y esperado lugar, etc., etc., which is beautiful in Spanish, but then can be translated only very clumsily into English.
So you would suggest then that the wild imaginings of the artists in their artist books, of course, are just as clumsy an instrument as to approaching the world of the inspiration as any other great tool.
Absolutely. I mean, it's up to you to confess, but has anyone of you achieved materially what you set out to imagine?
Oh. Never.
Maybe.
Every one of my books.
There's a brave man. Yes.
I dreamed about it. Precise.
Almost see what you want to do, but if you didn't do it, you'd never really see it.
Of course.
So that what the reason we're pushed to create or make a thing is so that we can't actually see it with our own eyes.
In that approximation, I think, lies the work. Borges has a wonderful definition of what he calls the aesthetic fact, the creation of art. He says, it is the imminence of a revelation that does not take place. And I think if we are honest, we have to console ourselves with the idea that that tension suffices. Yes?
What do you think the effect of the digital age is on the phenomena of imagination and dreaming?
Like any other instrument, it dictates certain rules and depends on us for its use. I don't like this tendency over the past decades of anthropomorphizing the electronic technology. Electronic technology does this and does that. It doesn't do anything that we don't want it to do within the limits of the technology, as any technology. There are dangers, as in any technology. With the invention of the car, we had to rethink using our muscles to walk. With the invention of the electronic technology, one of the dangers, I feel, is relying too much on the memory of the computer. We entrust our memory to the computer and we don't exercise it enough, just as we don't exercise enough our legs when we use the car. But these are limitations that we can overcome. The electronic technology offers us, as never before, the possibility of creating something extraordinarily multifaceted. The Wagner's idea of the Gesamtkunstwerk is possible now, but how can I say this without being offensive? I don't think that artists have yet taken the technology over in a sufficiently creative way. Everything that is done with the technology is translating what a previous technology does usually better. There is no point really in having, I know this is blasphemy, in having an electronic book. The Kovnix works so well. It's one of the few perfect things that we have created, like the wheel or the knife. If you want a blunt knife or a square wheel, you can create it, but it won't work better. But why not do something different? Why not do something that is not inspired by film, that is not as inspired by books, that is not as inspired by painting? Why not create another art form with this extraordinary tool? Well, I have yet to see it happen, but I'm hopeful. Yes. That's the question from which Pilate walked away. Imagination is a biological tool. Darwinians have showed how the human species, when it evolved, developed the imagination as an instrument for our species to survive, experiencing the world before experiencing the world materially, so that you could have an experience by imagining an experience. You don't need to put your hand in the fire in order to realize what would happen, and just imagine what would happen. And stories are born from that impulse. Now, what is the relationship to truth? Well, we have to get into a metaphysical swamp where we try to define truth. If we define truth as simply equivalent to reality, we have to admit that what we call reality is our perception as humans of reality, with our sense of time, our sense of space, which is not shared by the galaxies or by the ants. So, in the context of human experience, what we call truth is what we imagine to be the truth. And in that sense, Cervantes and Pierre Menard were right. Whatever we tell happened is what we think happened, what we know happened. outside the story, there is no reality. We can't say, this is what happened, and then on the side, on the margin, say, but truth is there. Well, what is that that is not named? I think it would be a useless exercise. So we have to resign ourselves once again that what we know of the universe is what we tell about the universe, and that most of it escapes us.
One last question. One last.
Okay.
No, not me, but we have time for one last question.
All right.
Do you record your own dreams or collect the dreams of others?
Pardon?
Do you record your own dreams or collect other people's dreams?
When they're interesting. I mean, there's nothing more boring than somebody telling you their dreams. But they're literary dreams that are wonderful,
oh,
and those I collect. Thank you very much.